welcome to the fourth episode of Woke-ish. This is Ebony.
And this is Zelma.
Thank you so much for listening to the last three episodes. This week we'll be talking about, in the What's Being Slept On segment, we'll be talking about double consciousness and class. But first, before we get there, we will start out with our shout-out segment. One tip, if you have anybody that you want to shout out, a person or a company, please shoot us an email at woke.ishpodcast@gmail.com or DM us on Instagram at woke.ishpodcast. So first we will start out with the Waffle House hero.
So I feel like sometimes the wrong person gets a lot of publicity, so there's been a lot of press about the suspect, which we'll kind of talk about later, but I wanted to highlight James Shaw, who is the person who actually tackled the suspect while he was reloading his gun. And people say that that actually saved a lot of lives because the intention of the shooter was to reload the gun and then continue shooting. And so he said that he was waiting. He went to the bathroom when he heard the gunshots and then like was looking at the shooter and then saw that he paused and that he was taking time to put more bullets in. And in that moment, just went over, rushed, and tackled him. And in the during that altercation, he actually got wounded. He suffered a graze wound from a gunshot and second-degree burn on his right hand. What I like about his story, you know, other than the fact that I really also do think that he saved a lot of people's lives, is that he's, like, really humble in saying that it was done for selfish reasons. Like, he himself didn't want to die, and so he wanted to stop that from happening. And so I think, like, there's even a quote where he said, if I was going to die today, I wasn't going to make it easy for him or something. And so after he was getting all this publicity, he kept saying, I'm not a hero. I was just doing what anyone else would done, which I don't know if that's necessarily true. I don't know if a lot of people would have done that. I don't know what I would have done in that situation. But I just like that afterwards, he went and visited the other victims. He's a father, yeah. And he's the same age as the shooter. So you have a black man who's 29 against a white guy who's 29. And, you know, in this story, the white guy is the guy that's shooting up people. And I feel like that's why I wanted to highlight him today and just kind of shout out James Shaw and say we need more people like him. And hopefully, if that ever happens, there's a James Shaw around for me. Right. But yeah, so that's my shout out for this week.
I was listening to his interview saying like how he did it for selfish reasons. Uh-huh. And I was like, well, you saved a bunch of people that are probably happy that you were being selfish.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, whatever way gets it done. And our second shout out will be to Ashley LaMoth. I think that I'm pronouncing it correctly. I think her maiden name is Ashley Derby. Ashley has been in the media a lot this past week as photos and information about her circulated. So at age 26, she became one of the youngest franchise owners at Chick-fil-A in history. Her Chick-fil-A story started many years before when she was 15 years old, and she started working at a Chick-fil-A restaurant outside of Atlanta. She continued working at Chick-fil-A while she was pursuing her BA at Spelman College, and as a one of the leadership programs that Chick-fil-A has, she was able to move up in the ranks and open her first restaurant in 2011. And now she's opening her second restaurant in also in Los Angeles downtown, which is also Chick-fil-A's first location downtown LA. So that's a pretty big deal. I used to work in this plaza, so I'm really familiar with this area, and I mean the location will do super well. I think that kind of goes without saying. Chick-fil-A is amazing. I'm a pretty big fan. Ashley LaMoth is a black woman. She is now 32 years old, but she opened her first Chick-fil-A franchise when she was 26 years old. So proud of her, and she is such a big inspiration. I love to see, you know, women kind of just excelling and breaking barriers, becoming the first to do all kinds of crazy things. Yeah, she's an inspiration to me, and I'm sure an inspiration to many others. Okay, so now we're going to move on. Okay, so now we're jumping into our In the Know segment, where we just discuss the latest kind of happenings and current events, things that are going on in the media. And we're going to start out by talking about Nicaragua.
Yeah, so I've been following this story on the news. In particular, one of the things I wanted to talk about was just the protests in Nicaragua. And so for a long time, Nicaragua has been just kind of having issues because the president has been the president for like many consecutive terms, slowly kind of making it undemocratic, but people were letting it go. And so one of the most recent things he did that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back was this social security reform, where he said that people would be putting more money in but getting less benefits out of it. And so, of course, with a country that's already economically unstable, where a lot of people don't have a lot of money to begin with, to tell them that they're going to not only have to give away more of their money to this government that they don't see as being super helpful, and then not getting anything in return was just kind of, and especially given the context that he's trying to be more authoritarian. And so
He just said
this is what we're going to do. And then people got really angry, and I don't think that he was there is a social security issue just like there is in this country, and his solution, which some people argue could be a solution here, is just to say, well, for right now, we're just going to pay more into it, and you'll just sacrifice and get less out, and that's how we can like get by. But a lot of people were just really upset, and so they protested and took this opportunity not only to protest social security reform, but just like a lot of things that they had been unhappy about. And what makes this a news story for me is the way that the government responded to the protests. And so the police kind of and the military just started shooting like live bullets at protesters. What's really troubling not only is the fact that they're shooting their own people, but that they really don't seem to give a shit. And I saw this one video where it was a reporter on Facebook Live, and you see him talking about how the ATMs weren't working. And like on TV, you see him get shot in the head and he dies. And people are freaking out. And at first, I was kind of like, I don't know if they should be showing this. This is someone dying. But then I was like, we wouldn't know that the Nicaraguan government is murdering its people if this wasn't something that, like, we saw. Because I bet that there would be some people who would say, no, I don't believe that the government is shooting their own people. But to see it, and that video went viral, and that video really caused a lot more international attention and put pressure on the president. And now he's kind of taking the reform back and saying, oh, no, it was just a suggestion. It was just something that I thought we could do. But what's just troubling is the way that he's kind of pulling in a Trump narrative by saying it's American imperialism that is manipulating these young people, especially students, to go against Nicaragua. So he's kind of making it seem like it's not the fact that there's actually issues that cause people to want to protest, but that they're being manipulated by America, by these ideologies of this colonial bad guy, and so they're just puppets and they're being super disrespectful for protesting. And so I just wanted to bring that into conversation, just because I know sometimes it's really easy to get lost in the mess that happens in the United States, but I wanted to highlight this as to like a ripple effect of Trump. Like people, like the government in this instant in a whole different country is using Trump as a kind of like, well, these people are going with what he's saying and they're racist. Do you really want to support these students that are following this racist ideology? And I'm kind of like, and a lot of us are really upset at like, how can you really try to spin it that way? But the more that I see how fake news can be taken to real news, how people in power can use whatever kind of evidence to support whatever they want, I just wanted to highlight that it's not just an American issue. Like Trump and his whole swaying, pathologically lying about things, always changing sides, his racism, like people outside of the US see that, and people don't always just disregard it. Now we see an instance where it's being used as a kind of shield for as to why it's okay to turn people against their own people by saying that they're like Trump. And so
he is saying that the students that oppose this reform are doing this because they're racist.
Are manipulated by American ideology, which is racist.
And what is the American ideology?
He's not saying. He's just, the government is really just pulling from their ass and saying, like, well, you guys know Trump is bad, right? And Trump says racist shit about brown people. So Trump is, and the U.S. has a history of kind of inserting themselves into our politics, and this is happening right now.
Well, so I think, that's what I was trying to get clarity on. It sounds like he's misinformed, because Trump is super against protest, demonstration, anything that is in opposition of the mainstream politics.
Yeah.
You know, and so, in actuality, the way that we protest, I mean, in a democratic society, predates Trump.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with him. And in actuality, we're often protesting against him. So it seems like the students there, if they are taking anything out of anything from America, it is the right to protest and the right to express your disdain for whatever the government is doing.
He's taking a page out of Trump's handbook, which is just lie.
Say
whatever it is, and then try to turn people against the real guy, the real bad guys, which are the military police, who have literally said, I follow on Instagram because in a country where the government has so much control over the media, you can't trust what comes out of the media. So thank goodness for social media, where people from Nicaragua are able to say, no, this is what's happening.
Yeah.
And there are people saying that the government is telling them after this time, there's a curfew. If you're out, you'll be shot. We gave you a warning. Kind of, and that's how they're trying to unmotivate protesters.
This sounds like apartheid.
It sounds, and it's just scary. And so I wanted to bring it into conversation just so we can be aware of not only the triple effects of Trump, but also how people all over the world can't sometimes want more from their government, and the government, instead of listening and saying maybe they have a point, it's just so much easier to pick apart why they're wrong and to make the protesters into criminals. So we'll definitely keep following that up, and as time passes and maybe things calm down or whatever, I'll keep updating people. But it was definitely something that's been just really heavy to watch and follow, just because especially when it's student-led, because us as academics and us being students, it's kind of to see the students be in a way made to seem like they're just following American values, they don't really care about the people of Nicaragua, is another strategy that people have used to kind of say these people are bad, and that can be really dangerous.
I think creating any division within your country can be dangerous. And not even can, but will be dangerous. Because I don't think that human beings necessarily have a violent nature, but I think that as time progresses, we are clinging even more so to our beliefs. And so I think that if anything, that's something that's being taken from our government, is that you see the government really trying to incite anger and conflict and tension between the left and the right.
Yeah.
Between whites and people of color.
Yeah.
And doing it in really overt and extreme ways. Every other tweet from Trump is about how liberals are this, liberals are that.
Yeah.
And so it creates this false sense of a divide, when in actuality we all care about the same thing. We just can't agree on the means to that end.
Yeah.
And so if anything, this president is taking, like you're saying, a page out of Trump's book and just spewing all types of nonsense and things like that, that his base is probably holding on to and saying, this is the reality. Look at what the president is saying. Look at what these, I don't know what the language would be that they would use there, but for Trump's language, these liberal college students.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So it's look at what these college students are that are opposing the government's rule. They're the problem.
You know,
these revolutionaries. And it's so I think that a lot of politicians want democracy, but don't actually know don't actually understand what that's going to look like, and aren't open to whatever it ultimately ends up being, which is that the people have a voice.
Yeah, and one of that being the President of the United States. So kind of shifting back to in-house, issues in-house that we have of division. To know if I just wanted to briefly mention two incidences at Waffle House.
Waffle House has been having some, yeah, like last week it was Starbucks, and
that's
this week
true.
It, all right, the week before that Walmart, then Starbucks, and now Waffle House.
Gosh, all these places, new places you learn. Every week we'll just show you a new place that you can't be safe. So I wanted to just kind of briefly compare these two situations, just as, because sometimes people ask me, what does racism look like? This isn't racism, because they think racism means, like we talked about previously, saying the N-word, saying, calling people derogatory terms, lynching. They're like, that's racism. But I wanted to highlight what racism looks like in this situation. And so if you've been following the Waffle House shooter story, he was finally caught in the woods. He was caught, he was armed, he had a loaded gun in his backpack.
Well, should we give a little bit of background about the incident before we
talk
about what, you know, sum it up? A white 29-year-old man entered a Waffle House with guns that had been previously taken from him by the police and given to his father. His father was instructed not to give him those guns, not to allow those guns to be made accessible to him because he was perceived to be a danger to society. Somehow, his father allowed him access to those guns. He took one of them and headed into, you know, his local Waffle House.
Without pants on.
He was nude underneath his jacket.
Yeah.
And just proceeded to shoot up this Waffle House.
People of color.
Yeah, people of color. He killed, I think, 4 people.
Yeah.
Some other people were injured. Everybody scattered, as you could probably imagine. And one man that Zelma gave a shout out to in the segment actually took this guy down.
Yeah, and he was on the run. So finally, they found him in some woods. They arrested him alive, and he had a loaded gun on his possession. And I think what I gathered from social media through Sean King, which I love, he always like posts things that help me learn about things, is that initially there wasn't so much opposition to letting him out on bond. Like they were going to let him out on bond, but so many people protested specifically to that location and said like, no, this person killed people, he shouldn't be allowed. And finally they were like, okay. So I think they set bond like millions of dollars, where it made it like super hard for him to be able to get out. But I think that the point Sean King was making was the only reason why that was even happening is because of the media attention that story got and the reaction of people to put pressure to not let him out on bond.
Yeah, the fact that that was even something that the court considered or posed as an option for a murderer.
Yeah.
A murderer who is obviously not very mentally stable, who would be released on bond to family members that don't take his mental instability seriously, who allowed guns back in his possession after they had already been revoked.
Yeah.
So I think that the fact that that was even on the table, and if there's any takeaway from that that doesn't have to do with race, that person is blind to the truth. Because there's no way in heck. There are people that have committed nonviolent crimes who are people of color that get no bail.
Yeah.
So how is it that someone that killed 4 people and would have killed several others had someone not, you know, stepped up and somehow dug up the courage to try to take him out?
Stop him, yeah. And then we have another incident where Shakisha Clements, who I believe is 25, was arrested in Waffle House in Alabama on April 22nd. And so there's a video of her arrest, and that's what's going viral. And in the video, she is like being like not only manhandled, but I would argue sexually assaulted by 2 to 3 police officers. Because three white police officers were called to handle this one woman. And apparently, people claim that she was drunk and that she was trying to take like utensils or something. Regardless of what the issue was, their reaction was to physically restrain her in a manner that I'm really surprised that she doesn't have any more, like she didn't break something. And I think even on the video, one of the police officers says, I'm gonna break your arm.
Yeah, he literally said that.
And so This is, I have a quote about the response of the police. So, local police maintain that the three officers involved followed protocol and said the department is not choosing to take any action at this time. And then at a news conference Monday afternoon, the official said the woman and her friend were acting belligerent inside the Waffle House. They were drunk, yelling profanities, and then threatened to return with a gun and shoot this place up. So that's what they're saying is the motivation behind treating her that way. But yet, a person who actually did shoot up a Waffle House.
Where there's no speculation, you know for a fact.
Because he was doing it. He didn't say he was going to come back. Like, he was doing it. And the fact that the police in that area decided that they had to be pressured into not... One, he wasn't immediately caught. Like, he wasn't shot on sight like they would to so many other people. And two, he was even given... Like, they had to be pressured into not letting him out on bond.
Yeah.
And so why was his situation different, where there was actual murders of people involved, where there's no question of who did the murdering, compared to this woman who they claim it was because she was drunk? And it's beyond whether she should have been arrested at all. It's how she was treated by police officers. Like, she wasn't, one, a person. Two, like, if that were, I think, a woman of any other race, people would have really, the women march, the women people would have really come and been like, oh no, you can't treat women this way. Because, like, during the altercation, they, like, exposed her breasts. They didn't even give her the opportunity to cover herself.
They pull her to the floor.
Yeah.
Two men are on top of her while she's on the floor.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, an argument that I haven't necessarily heard, but that I could imagine people make, is that the people in the situation with the Waffle House shooter, the police officers, in not killing him, behaved appropriately. The people, or not, you know, acting violently toward him. The people that were, the police that were involved in the Shakisha incident, reacted improperly. I mean, even though they're saying that it wasn't race-based, even though they are saying that they acted according to protocol. So I think that what those two situations highlight is that, okay, perhaps one set of police officers or one police department does behave in a way that they are supposed to, and another doesn't. That still underscores an issue. The problem is that there is no uniformity in the way that police departments are organized, in the way that police officers are trained. It seems as though certain police departments allow their officers to behave in any way that they choose to. So whether that be in racist ways, sexist ways, classist ways, all of these things, all of this bias, and then there are other departments that don't behave in that way. But when you know that one bad apple spoils the bunch, what it would seem is that I, as a police chief or as the head of police, I would make sure that all of these people are on, you know, McDonaldization of the police department. Everybody needs to be structured. Everybody needs to understand that there are certain ways that are acceptable to behave, and if you don't behave in those ways, then you'll be fired, just like anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you go to any job, you're late enough times, they're going to fire you because you're not supposed to do that. Why is it that police are allowed to repeat the same problematic behavior over and over and over and over again with no repercussions and no fear of repercussions? It seems like now they are desensitized to recording. Like, they don't care that it's on camera. I don't know when the last time was that I saw a police officer say you can't record. Like, there is not even any fear in that.
Yeah.
Because they recognize that even with that, nothing will be done.
Yeah.
And so to feel like it is appropriate for you to tackle a woman to the ground who is in a strapless dress. Like, why? She doesn't, when you come, now, whether or not she was drunk and belligerent before they came or before the camera came on, we can't say. But while she was interacting with the police, she was not. So
yeah.
For what reason did they treat her that way?
Yeah.
Simply based on he said, she said. They trusted the words of whoever called them, rather than treating her appropriately based on the way that she was interacting with them. And so, I think that these people regardless of what the chief said or whatever, they have no credibility. Like, you're on camera tackling a woman to the ground, doing all these...
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, police, if anything, should be taught how to de-escalate situations.
Right.
So if you're at a point where three white, regardless of race, but they happen to mostly be white police officers, if you come to a situation where you see one person, a woman, and three guys feel the need to all tackle her, then I feel like maybe you don't have adequate training to de-escalate a situation.
No, definitely.
And if you can't handle this one person at a Waffle House being quote-unquote drunk and belligerent, then how are you going to handle a high-stakes situation where there's actually, like, laws being broken where people's lives are at risk, or at stake?
Yeah. The way that a police department behaves in a particular state or city should not have to be a deterrent for people who are a certain skin complexion to live there. Or, you know, like, there are people that are literally afraid of LAPD.
Yeah.
There shouldn't be as much variation in treatment and behavior as there is.
Yeah.
Like, we can't, I mean, I don't know. Like, I definitely think that, I think that something has to give. Because I think that people either, it seems right now that a lot of people are numb. But I think that there will come a point where the, like, patience runs out.
Yeah.
Patience runs out. And I think that we're getting close to that. Because there's no other way to go. Like, somebody's going to do something crazy that's just going to send us into this. You know, I don't know if I would call it a revolution, but
let's figure out what horrible event, because so many horrible things that has happened.
Yeah.
But what is it gonna take for there to be this?
I'm afraid,
like, for police to finally be like, okay, maybe that isn't
too far.
That is too far. That's the line. Like, having to, it's sad that we have to wait until there's this line that police and a lot of people can agree on, that's the line that's too far.
That's what I'm waiting for. Not necessarily the police, but I'm waiting for people that are, you know, Blue Lives Matter, these people that think that the police can do no wrong. I'm waiting for a situation where their eyes are opened.
Yeah.
Where they, because we need them. We need them to, I mean, who's electing, you know, police chiefs? You know, we need people that understand and empathize with the plight. If you don't even think there's a plight, then we can't we can't depend on you, because you don't even see the issue. So it's like, it's one thing to see an issue and be like, yeah, I see it, but I'm not passionate enough to do anything about it. Okay, that's another thing. But to be like, no, there's no issue, y'all deserve this, is that gets us nowhere. We have to fight. Not only do we have to fight against the police, but we also have to fight against those people. Thanks for that, Zama. That is just, I mean, really...
Yeah, so hopefully that we were able to talk out, like, to, you know, because it's both at Waffle Houses, I was like, maybe that will allow people who always want to try to find a reason for why it's not racism to kind of have to really think about, well, why was it different? They were both, quote-unquote, doing something that was against the rules, against the laws, against whatever, but one was treated way differently and one was not, and what's the difference between those two?
Okay, so, and then this last in the know, which I'll try to keep it brief, but probably because so many people have been seeing this all over social media for the last week, but this young lady, Candace Owens, who is a Black conservative, and I think that she rejected the title far right, or that the, like, categorization, but if you listen to any of her interviews, or, you know, her Fox News interviews or her, like, YouTube videos, that a lot of the language that she uses is really reminiscent of, you know, far right conservatives. And so she surfaced this past week. Really, I mean, it was really interesting how I came across her page, because I think that someone pointed her out to me, and then I went and listened to some of her videos, and then, like, but she's been up on social media since the end of 2017, and somehow I just stumbled upon her, like, 2 days before she just completely blew up.
Yeah.
And so I was like, what are the chances that this would be the week that she just, I mean, I guess it's Kanye coming back onto Twitter. So she blew up because Kanye tweeted her name, and he said he likes the way that Candace Owens thinks. Which, I mean, then she got reposted by, like, the Shade Room and you know, that brought a lot of eyes to her social media platforms, which other people have problematized because it's like, well, Kanye is making her popular for, you know, saying really problematic things. But apparently, as the week kind of progressed, we found out that these are ideas that he actually also shares. Because she is, Candace Owens is pro-Donald Trump. She said that Donald Trump was the savior.
Yeah.
And she thinks that he is gonna, I don't know, lead us into some place prosperous.
He's gonna make America great again.
Yeah, that he's gonna make America great again, whatever mm-hmm. that means. Mm-hmm. And now, after having tweeted about her and liking the way that she, and saying that he likes the way that she thinks, Kanye is now also coming out of the closet as a Trump fan and supporter, wearing Make America Great Again hats.
Yeah, that was signed.
Yeah, a signed hat. And today, Donald Trump retweeted him.
Yeah.
And, you know, and kind of not necessarily expressed support for Kanye, but just kind of said, you know, very cool.
Like, yeah, you know, actually said very cool.
Yeah, he said thanks, you know, the very cool. And Kanye called him a brother, said that, you know, he's his brother.
Blood. I don't know, he was...
Yeah, Kanye is falling off the deep end. But what I really wanted to talk about is this Candace Owens woman. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with being a black conservative or being black and being Republican.
Yeah,
I think that that's entirely fine. Yeah. Now, where the issue that I do have is where she has a video, and I was so sad that she was invited to by UCLA. But UCLA has a kind of like young Republican organization called mm-hmm. Bruins United, and like when I was in college, we always had conflict with them because a lot of the ideas that they propagated were, you know, like young Republican stuff. And so I guess they invited her, or a you know, sister organization invited her out to speak about her views, and she started talking about Black Lives Matter, and she was at one point talking directly to Black Lives Matter because some of their representatives had attended and were kind of protesting, kind of shouting back at her. But generally, her ideas are that black people are too stuck in their past. She said that there are people that are focused on slavery and focused on planning, and there are categorized as black people into victims and victors, and says that black people that talk about the past and talk about the historical mistreatment of black folks in America are people that are dwelling and that can't focus on their future. And so, obviously, as a person that does both, I have an issue with that because it's kind of it kind of paints this image of black folks as being, you know, like these categories are mutually exclusive. Like, you can't problematize the past and also look to the future and also be working toward your future. And you can certainly do both. So I think that one thing that she plays down a lot is the intergenerational transmission of opportunity, wealth, education, just, I mean, everything is passed down.
Yeah.
So obviously, yes, you can deviate from your parents, what your parents teach you, what your grandparents teach you, and all of that. And over time, you can become more upwardly mobile, even if you were raised in poverty. Yes. But if there is a systematic, you know, maltreatment of a particular group, then it makes it difficult to become upwardly mobile.
Yeah.
Not to say that it's completely impossible. Yeah, I mean, there are plenty of ways that you can, there are plenty of ways that people have found to access middle class status or to access a college education. But it is, there are more hurdles in front of certain groups. That's just the reality. So you, even if you are, I know plenty of folks that oppose Black Lives Matter, not necessarily their mission, but their tactics. And so I can understand that. I can understand how you can still, you can agree with the end that this group is trying to get to, but you don't agree with their means of getting there. You know, so a lot of folks don't like protest.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of folks don't like boycotts. You know, like, they don't like things that make life difficult.
Yeah.
Or shine a light, a negative light, from their perspective, on the group. And so they think that Black Lives Matter brings too many eyes on the black, onto the black community and makes them look kind of negative in the eyes of, like, mainstream white folks. All right, fine. That is your argument, whatever. But if you, but you recognize that what Black Lives Matter is fighting for is the end to police brutality. And, I mean, just in general, the differential treatment of black men by our law enforcement, by our government, by our just our judicial system, everything. And so you can, even if you don't like Black Lives Matter, you can agree that that is a problem.
Yeah.
She is saying that there is no problem.
Yeah.
She is saying that Black Lives Matter is full of whiners, full of complainers. She said that they are like toddlers throwing a temper tantrum. So I'm wondering, you know, I've been wondering all week what it is that that this woman is missing. You know, she exists in the world just like all of us. And so even if it's class, even if it is that she grew up wealthy, yes, you can be removed, and yes, you can not necessarily feel connected with people who live in poverty. That is understandable. But you are no less black than any of us.
Yeah.
And I think that that is something that she, or I thought that that wasn't something that she realized. I was thinking that maybe she doesn't see how white people view us differently until I stumbled across an article in the Root, and it highlights that Candace Owens, back when this was, I guess, after she had graduated high school, she and her family sued her school district, and they were suing over racist attacks toward Candace by some of her classmates or people that also attended her school, who were white boys. And so it just, I found this kind of entertaining because I was like, well, this woman who understands and knows what, and you know, like being called names by white kids or by white people is just a facet, a sliver of what racism actually is.
Yeah.
But she understands that sliver.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's, I mean, in all her videos and her tweets and everything, she kind of, her ideology is that racism doesn't exist. It's that we are complaining about something that our great grandparents went through that they weren't even complaining about when they went through it, which is like BS, girl. What? I just think that it's really super entertaining that she understands that sliver of racism and benefited from it monetarily, mm-hmm. but is now, you know, granted, it's a few years later. She, in 2016, wrote an open letter to the Stanford Advocate, which is a kind of like local online newspaper in Connecticut, which I guess is where she's from. So she went to Stanford High School, and maybe in a reflection piece in 2016, wrote this open letter to kind of describe what it was that she went through, how following this incident she suffered from, you know, some like mental health issues, and she developed an eating disorder and all of these things. But ultimately, even if you are 9 years after the fact reflecting on it and, you know, saying that you sympathize with the people that taunted you and all of that, you still benefited tens mm-hmm. of thousands of dollars from this plight of racism that you are now claiming doesn't even exist.
Yeah.
And I mean, this the way that these white boys treated her is a consequence and like a symptom of the broader issues of racism in America. So the structural issues, the structural inequality, racial discrimination, all of these things, they're interconnected with, you know, individual level like racist interactions and stuff like that, individual level discrimination and all of that. All of these things are interconnected. One thing wouldn't exist without another because they're human beings that actually, you know, institute certain policies. They're human beings that live and work and occupy institutions. And so they carry on. These little white boys might hate her now because she, you know, there was a light that was shown on their racism. And then who knows what they went on to do with their lives. Who knows what types of ideologies they took into whatever institutions that they occupy. And so it's like, I mean, it's a double-edged sword. Like, you can't hold on to racism when it benefits you.
Yeah.
But then turn a blind eye to it in order to bolster your political or whatever career.
Yeah, like, and it is, not be transparent about it to say, because I don't know if I've ever heard from her about this lawsuit or about this, or that she doesn't, now she thinks differently and kind of acting like this is just how she's always thought. And so when you try really hard to present yourself one way, but then there's these things that show that you didn't always think that way, it makes me kind of wonder why it's convenient for you to be presenting your ideas now in the way that they are now.
Yeah. And I mean, you could, I guess she could have said maybe that, you know, this was high school, you know, it was my parents that wanted to sue, I didn't, yada, 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 whatever. You wrote this open letter 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Like, this is not, you, and in this open letter, you're not saying, oh, no, that wasn't racism, they're just misguided young boys. No, you're calling it what it is. You're calling a spade a spade.
Yeah.
And now, 2 years later, you just had this incredible change of heart where Trump is your savior, Kanye West lyrics are your Bible, he's your hero.
Yeah.
Like, she's talking about Kanye is her, she listens to Kanye every day,
every day.
Everything that she is because of Kanye. Like, girl, sit down. Sit down. And to act like you're, to act like she has that, like, Bill Cosby complex where she thinks that, like, she is gonna rectify all that is wrong with the black community. And it's like, no, you are not gonna single-handedly, and even if let's just say that that is her interest, why are you preaching to roomfuls of alt-right white men?
Yeah.
Like, what is it that you're getting from that? Why are you pretending like you're interested in helping the black community and bringing them to the light, showing them how Democrats are actually wolves in sheep's clothing and Republicans are the way that we need to go. How, there's just so many things that are problematic about this girl. Like, one of her whole videos about why black people shouldn't be Democrats is based on 1960s politics. So saying, oh, Democrats weren't always interested in you. Okay, so why are you looking so far into history, into the past, but you're telling us not to? Like, you cannot base your entire argument on something that happened during the Civil Rights Movement. These are not the same people.
Yeah, and then say that you can't also use that evidence as argument for why racism, the consequences of racism persist now. Yeah, no, I mean,
this goes crazy.
Which will continue this conversation into our What's Being Slept On segment. But we just wanted to give a background into, one, not only who she was, because she's starting to gain more recognition, but also this problematic issue Ebony found, in that there's a history where she seemed to have benefited from the very thing that she claims to say is a problem.
Yeah, or to say doesn't even exist.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was like, you're talking about crying over racism, but you cried and got paid for crying.
So I strongly suggest that you wake the fuck up.
So this week in What's Being Slept On, we are discussing double consciousness and the role of class.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of transitioning from our conversation about Kanye and how far from the tree Kanye has fallen in these last few years. Because this is not the same Bush don't give a fuck about black people Kanye. This is not the same Kanye that went up there and said, you know, I'm gonna let you finish, Taylor, but Beyonce. Like, you know, like, where is that Kanye? Like, he has, you know, now this is the, like you said, pick yourself up by the bootstraps Kanye. This is, you know, the United States is a meritocracy Kanye. This is, you know, that they are continuing to support Democrats when they need to support Republicans, and that's the way forward.
Yeah, in my million-dollar home, as I go travel to all these different countries and isolate myself in all these areas to write music, I know what black people feel.
Yeah. This is not Southside Chicago Kanye that understood poverty.
Yeah.
That understood concentrated poverty. Understood that when you pack, because that's essentially what the government has done with redlining, which is, you know, kind of legalized segregation.
Yeah. Which is pushing people of color into certain areas that are deemed undesirable and having their property tax worth less, and then pushing white people into better areas so that, like you're saying, it's all packed in one in one area where police don't want to go, people don't want to go, businesses don't want to go, kind of setting up people for failure. So that's what Ebony means by redlining.
Yeah, so even if, so with that, like, if you subscribe, if you believe that black people or poor people generally live amongst one another just by happenstance or just like kind of by accident, like, oh, dang, all these poor people live together. No, that was strategic. You can actually look up redlining. Like, that is a legitimate term that is still allowed. It's, I think it's unethical, but it's not illegal. Like, they still, you know, they still do it. Realtors still only show certain people houses in certain areas.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that happened to me, like, as a person. Like,
yeah.
Figuring out that I, that there was places shown to someone I knew who was white that weren't shown to people who weren't white.
Yeah. This is, I mean, this is a reality. And so I think that somewhere along the way, and, you know, I've heard some people say that, like you said earlier, that it might be because of, you know, Kanye's mother passing away, and that kind of sent him on this downward spiral, which could be legitimate, but a lot of the stuff about Bush and all of that and his, you know, social and political views were still intact that happened. And it just seems that recently, with him being so immersed in this Kardashian clan, that he has shifted, you know? And so that kind of ties in well, we thought, with a conversation about class and how people of color are, well, I guess I'll speak about black people since Kanye's black. Like, black people are not a monolith. There are variations based on, I mean, a ton of social differences.
Yeah.
And because we're talking about class this week, we'll focus on that. But it's like, is it that he's wealthy and then all of a sudden that wealth became tied with these political views? I do think to a certain extent, you know, if you have a lot of money and you're getting taxed out the ass, you might be fiscally conservative.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with that. Yeah. I know people that are that
way,
and
no,
it makes sense
too.
To me.
Yeah,
it's like,
why you would want these policies that benefit you because you make more money. Like, that makes sense.
Yeah. But it's like, don't because you are wealthy and you're being taxed six figures, try to get black people whose experience is not that, black people who are poor, to come and vote in a way that would support you, but would leave them hanging out to dry.
Yeah.
Like, you, as a wealthy person, don't want big government. Fine. But big government benefits poor black folks.
Yeah.
It does. They depend on a lot of those services. Growing up, my family used all of those services.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, I can't lie and say it didn't help us. And I know that Kanye probably knows folks, based on some of his music, knows folks that also benefit from some of that stuff. People who he said, you know, were dependent on him and were on his payroll.
Yeah.
You know, so if you, I just don't buy into that, like, oh, we gotta keep all of these resources from these people and that's gonna push them to make more money. That's gonna push them to do better. Like, no, I think there's a bigger issue. There's a bigger, inequality is a bigger issue. And it's not going to be fixed just by removing resources.
Yeah. And then to make it seem like his experience is the black experience.
Yeah.
Like, he understood. And then once again, reifying that the black experience is something that is uniform and the same is problematic. And so I wanted to start the conversation by kind of talking about what double consciousness is, because it started from Du Bois, and just kind of going from examples of double consciousness that we see. So, Ebony, did you want to kind of break that down?
Yeah, so I can just read this definition. So, double consciousness is a concept that Du Bois first explored in 1903 in his book, The Souls of Black Folk. Double consciousness describes the individual sensation of feeling as though your identity is divided into several parts, making it difficult or impossible to have one unified identity. Du Bois spoke of this within the context of race relations in the United States. He asserted that since American blacks have lived in a society that has historically repressed and devalued them, that it has become difficult for them to unify their black identity with their American identity. Double consciousness forces blacks to not only view themselves from their own unique perspective, but to also view themselves as they might be perceived by the outside world. So kind of just to unpack that, essentially what Du Bois is saying is that all black people, regardless of class, experience what is called double consciousness, where as a black person, as someone that is a devalued member of society but has to exist in mainstream society, you have your black experience, you have your black worldview, you have your black consciousness, you have your black perspective, but then at the same time, you also see yourself from the eyes of the mainstream. You recognize that you are a discriminated body. You recognize that you are invalued. You recognize that your body is considered or viewed as a threat and treated as such. And that leads you to experience a life of double consciousness where you're constantly feeling torn between two worlds. So granted, you might be Black American and live in America and be technically American by American's definitions, but you aren't necessarily American by American standards, or I guess mainstream American standards. Mm-hmm. So the fact that we are all American, we should all see one another as, you know, our people, but we don't. There is a division. There is a division whereby being Black American means one thing, being Latin American means one thing, White American means something different. And there are tons of people who do a lot of work to try to act as though those divisions don't exist, to try to act as though those divisions are not kept in place and that there aren't a lot of folks at the top who are also doing work to keep those things in place, that act as though our policy doesn't maintain those divisions. And so if we add class on top of that, I think that that exacerbates double consciousness. Also, to complicate it even more so, not just, like, it's one thing, I think, to be black and born into middle class. But if you are, if you grew up poor and then accessed middle class status via, like, your education or via, like, Kanye, like, you know, the music industry and a lot of other entertainers, you know, that have talked about their past and talk about their family, their extended family, who a lot of their extended family still lives in poverty. Mm-hmm. I think that those are also different experiences. So different experiences. So there is a lot of variation in the way that people access upward mobility. And I think that that makes it even more difficult to exist in the world, because to outsiders, to the outside gaze, you're just a black person. And to them, we all act and think alike. And so if you're someone that knows that you have money, knows that you worked to get this money, that might feel like, you know, a bit conflicting. So I could see how Kanye and a lot of other people might have a hard time with that. But
yeah,
I mean, do you think that, I don't even know, because I wouldn't consider double consciousness necessary. I was going to say, do you think that he suffers from double consciousness? But I don't think I would consider it a suffering. I'm just wondering, I guess I'm wondering how or what of the way he thinks could be motivated by that.
I think maybe he's trying. I think one of the things to me that I find difficult is like the consequences, both mentally and physically and economically, of trying to piece those two things together. So like navigating your life in a way that matches your experience as a minority with the experience of American, of being an American. Mm-hmm. And so I think that maybe we're actually like watching him try to piece that together, because there are hints of him being like talking about the black experience. I mean, even like looking at his lyrics, reading some of his lyrics and reading about the things that he talks about, I'm like, okay, that's, you know, you understand what it's like to be a minority. But then the narrative of American, like being an American is unity, like this is dividing us, like mm-hmm. Trump is in office now, that's who we should go behind, like why are we trying to divide each other? Because that narrative and that idea is based on the experience of just being an American, and in this case a white American, because when we talk about the American experience, we're talking about the white American experience, because that's the mainstream experience. And so I think with Kanye and with sometimes other people that I see, It's them trying to piece it together, like trying to make those two things fit and they don't fit. Yeah, they don't. Because they, yeah. The two experiences are different. And sometimes, I say this a lot, that I feel like I live, you know, and I've been in an interracial relationship in the past, and I would talk all the time about, we may live in the same world, but we don't live in the same world. And kind of saying, like, we just have everything was different. Even the way that I was treated at a restaurant. Like, there's just, everything is different when you're not white. And I think sometimes for a lot of people who are white, who never have to experience that, who never have to acknowledge or really feel their race, they don't see how race can be an issue because it's not an issue for them.
Yeah.
And so that part of their American story is being white. And part of being white is not having to deal with a lot of issues that are shaped by your race. And when you are a person of color in this, you know, Du Bois was talking about Black Americans, but I would argue that now we can kind of see that in the framework of, like, Muslim Americans, immigrants who are here, who've become Americans, you know, Latino Americans, like, you just... you feel that you don't, but you aren't the type of American that people are talking about. Like, there's just this feeling, and in this, and for me personally, like, I do, being in academia, there are times where I feel like I'm saying some things that I'm learning in school about why things are the way they are, how things can be neutral, how all these things, but then my experience as a person of color kind of, there's a conflict there. And in my head, I don't know how to put those two together. And so sometimes I literally have to, like, turn it off and be like, okay, just don't think about it. Just, like, go with this. Or, like, even talking about racism and, like, the, can people of color be racist, is a good example for me. Like, in school, when we talk about how, you know, it's about power and it's about all this stuff, and being like, okay, like, as an academic, I can sit here and have this conversation, but as a person of color who has been called a wetback, as a person of color who has been called these racial terms, like, it's really hard for me to be like, you know, racism to me is more than just a concept. It's like an actual negative experiences that shape my, and that is hard to convey to people if they've never experienced. It's even when I would tell white friends or my white partner, like, this happened to me one time. Someone literally told me to go back to Mexico. This happened to me one time. Someone asked me why I wasn't speaking in English. And, like, to say that is not the same as to experience that. And so I feel like with Kanye, ultimately, what, to me, it just looks like he's trying to piece the American narrative and the Black American and the Black narrative. And I don't know if he's being successful at merging the two, and he's actually just trying to convince everyone that the American narrative is the narrative, is the experience.
Yeah. I mean, I think that Kanye might be, and this Candace Owens girl, you know, so we talk a lot about white guilt. And I think that there might also be a Black guilt. You know, and I think that it's, you know, I came from poverty and now I'm wealthy. And so that might come with a certain degree of guilt, where you know that where you left, the place that you left, there are still tons of people there going through what you once experienced. And so you might feel like an obligation to somehow rectify or negotiate that tension that you feel internally by either trying to do something about it or flipping it on them and saying, you need to do what I did, pick yourself up and go get the money that you need.
Yeah.
Go, you know, change your life. Go get an education. Go do this. Go do that. And I think that it's really easy to fall into that.
Yeah.
You know, because, like, I mean, I go home often and am often, like, you know, looking at certain people. So, obviously, not everybody, but looking at certain people and, like, why are you acting like that? Why do you need to be this belligerent talking to this clerk, or, you know, cussing out this person or that person, or cussing out your kids and dragging your kids through the grocery store? Like, it's something that I have to check myself about after the fact, or sometimes I don't.
Yeah.
But I think that one thing to be aware of and to really be reflexive about is where these thoughts or feelings come from? What is the root of these thoughts and feelings? You know, is it about wanting to appease mainstream white America? Is it about respectability politics, where I want these folks to present themselves in a way that would align with mainstream expectations and meet mainstream standards? Well, for me, it is not. For me, I think that there are ways of treating people that are appropriate, and there are ways of treating people that are inappropriate. There are appropriate ways for disciplining your kid, especially in public, and there are inappropriate ways for disciplining your kid, especially in public. And that would be for anybody. And so I guess maybe that's how I kind of negotiate that tension, is like, you know, not wanting to really be judgmental, but wanting better for people just for the sake of wanting better for people, not to meet anybody else's standards.
Even recognizing that poverty is not something that people cause themselves, you know, so I do think that there are people that can be poor that are in a lot of ways responsible for some of the actions that kept them that way. But I don't think that poverty as a pattern or an epidemic is something that any individual caused. You know, like, I think that it's something that has been, like, that people are systematically oppressed, and that produces this poverty, and that there are certain actions that maintain it. But I don't think it's the fault of any of those, of any poor people necessarily. But I have made it a point to make sure that I don't use my experience to set my expectations for what other people should do. And I think that that's something that I've seen a lot of Black people do that quote unquote make it out the hood and are just like, well, I did it, so why can't you?
Yeah.
And it's like, I personally recognize all the people that helped me to get where I am. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't take all the credit for that. And I know that a lot of other people didn't have that. Now, if you have all of these resources at your disposal and you decide that, I'm not interested in that, I'd rather do this over here, and then that's on you. And that's a really unique experience. But rarely do people have all of these things handed to them and just abuse it.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think one example that constantly pops into my mind, and this is not a Black person, but for instance, Trump, right? So Trump claims that he started from the bottom.
Yeah.
But he founded his business using a $1 million loan from his father.
Yeah.
Now, would there be people that would take the $1 million and not be able to build a successful business? Yes. But then there are plenty of others that would be able to take the $1 million and start a successful business. You know, so it's like, I think that to make the claim that, you know, well, one, that having a father who has $1 million is starting from the bottom, I mean, that is so ridiculously unfathomable. If your father has $1 million to just give to you off a whim and say good luck with your business, he probably has $100 million other dollars where that came from. You know, so this is not, he's not giving you money that's going to put him in a hole. But I think that to act as though these are opportunities that everybody has access to is ridiculous. And I think that that's something that Kanye and a lot of other Black conservatives or Black Republicans feel, is that if we take these resources, these things that they see these people as leaning on, if we take these resources away from them, then they'll suddenly somehow work harder, because poor Black women that are working two jobs and raising kids by themselves are not working hard enough.
Yeah.
Like, if we take these resources away, they'll work harder, and then they'll somehow end up where we are.
Yeah, and I think that's based on, once again, the experience of the white American experience. And so when people of color, when white people and when people of color highlight, like, I as an exception made it this far, therefore it can be done, I think takes away from the fact that there are these consequences from years and years and years and years of inequality. And so, for instance, I, like, you know, I'm a health researcher, so I'll always bring up health examples. And so it is bad if your baby is born with a low birth rate. That not only contributes to kind of your baby being sick when they're born, but as they grow and develop into adults, being born at a low birth rate impacts your heart, impacts a lot of the development of your organs. So something that can go with you up into your 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s.
Yeah.
So it's a consequence all your life. And so we know that Black women tend to have babies with lower birth rates, and we don't know why. Well, we argue that it's because of the stress that they endure living due to racism, because of the lower economic status that Black women have. But what I find really alarming is that even highly educated women, Black women who are middle class, upper middle class, have PhDs, still have babies that have low birth weight. And so in that case, it doesn't matter how much money you have. It doesn't matter how educated you are, which white people would tell us, no, like, if you get yourself out, everything will be better. If, you know, it should be that, like, it happens with white women and many Latina women, that if you get into better economic mobility, better economic status, then your health should be better. But for Black women, it's not.
And because so, people assume that, like, oh, class makes you exempt.
Yes. Like, and you, so that's, yeah. That is one, like, physical example where we see that for Black women, it doesn't matter how educated you are, how much money you have, how poor you are. There's low birth weight across. And so, and that's an issue. And that results in these children being born with, like, lots of issues, not only in that developmental period, but in, as they grow older. And so, so if we don't recognize that there are consequences of race and racism that happen aside from class, then we kind of overlook those things and we make it seem like it's people themselves. And I would like someone to argue and tell me that it's the Black woman's fault that they're, you know, a lot of people would say, oh, a poor woman has a baby of low birth weight because she doesn't have enough to eat, mm-hmm. because they're not going to the doctor as they should, because of all these things. But then why is that happening to women who are highly educated and middle class and upper middle class? Like,
but see, I think that the reason that those arguments are difficult to win, especially when it comes to people that do subscribe and hold really tightly to their racist ideology, is the argument that, oh, well, like you said, you know, it, even though these inequalities persist across class lines, that would mean to them that there is a problem with Black women.
Mm.
Not necessarily that it's the experience of being Black. The experience that treatment come, that experience comes with maltreatment. In the form of racism, in the form of discrimination, in the form of stress, which affects, like, in terms of health, like, your allostatic load and all of these things.
Yeah.
Like, people don't, it's like, it's basically like, you know.
Two sides of the same coin?
There you go.
Is that it?
Yes.
Ooh, that
two sides of the same coin. That the coin, on one hand, you can say it's racism if you believe that or buy into it. And on the other side, it's Black people are pathological. They have all of these issues. They are inherently an issue. They're inherently problematic. So what is the consequence of that? That they have babies that are born with lower birth weights than people who are not?
Yeah.
I don't know. Black. So so it's, I mean,
you're right. People it's hard. Like, even when presented. And then another thing that I like to talk about is, you know, it you don't get the same return when you're non-white in this country as if you were white. So in terms of, like, education, and, you know, I run lots of models, I try to control, education is something that's supposed to really, really be good for your health. But what I've learned in my own studies and in learning about other people's studies is that for non-white people, we have to be really, 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 really educated to get the same amount of bump in health that a white person would get with just and a college degree. So a white person, you know, white people with a college degree, it would take a non-white person a master's or a PhD to be able to get the same kind of return on education for your health.
Yeah. So, I mean, even in education, wealth, you know, like, maybe Oprah is better off health-wise than I am.
Yeah.
But she is, like, you know, one of the wealthiest women in the world.
Yeah.
You know, but the woman that is making maybe, you know, that's maybe middle upper class is not doing that much better than me. Even the woman that's, even the Black woman that's upper class.
Yeah.
She's not doing very much better health-wise than poor Black folks. And then also, there is a difference in terms of the people that, like I said earlier, were born into their wealth.
Yeah.
So kind of never really had to never really had to face economic struggle, and people that were born into poverty but accessed wealth through education or through their career. That like few years or that like childhood spent in with exposure to poverty has lasting impacts on your health.
Yeah.
You know, so a lot of the stressors that poor Black children face are things that will continue to impact them health-wise throughout their life.
Yeah.
You know, by the time you're 18, a lot of the diseases that you might die from have already started to grow
in your body.
Yeah, they're already there. So it's not something that like, you know, oh, at 25, 26, or, you know, in your 30s, you access wealth and then suddenly all is right with the world.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Maybe your kids and stuff like that. That's the importance of understanding intergenerational transmission.
Yeah.
Because it's not even, if you become wealthy as an adult, it's not something that would benefit you.
Yeah, or if it does, it wouldn't benefit you as much as someone who is white, which is, again, what we're stressing. Like, even if there are people who make it to this higher level, who gain economic mobility, if you're Black and you become a millionaire, all these different things, like, you still don't get the same return on your wealth, on your education, on your status that you would if you were a white person. And to me, like, that is unequal. And if you only hold on to the narrative that in America, everyone has on an equal playing field, in America, you can pull yourself up, in America, we have Black people who are billionaires, in America, you can be a Kanye, where we can grow up really poor and then have multi-million selling albums, like, no, that doesn't happen to everyone. That happens to actually like very, very, very few people. And even Kanye as a Black man does not have the same return on his wealth than a white man does.
He does not. But Kanye 5 years ago understood that. Kanye today believes that he can buy access to, you know, white privilege. And it's, no, the door is shut on that. Like, your skin is too dark. It doesn't matter how white you marry.
Yeah, even if you're allowed, like Candace Owens, even if you're allowed on Fox News, even if you are retweeted by white conservatives, even if you are applauded by the president, like, that doesn't mean that behind closed doors, President Trump is not calling you the same thing that he calls any other person who looks like you.
Yeah, and maybe you can afford not to care about that. Mm. Maybe you don't have to, maybe you can afford not to rely on, or you can afford not to be affected by the policy changes and things like that that Trump makes, because ultimately what you're concerned about are your taxes, and that's also a concern that Trump shares with him because he's so wealthy. So you might benefit to a certain extent from some of the policies that he implements, but at the end of the day, guess what? You'll still be Black. You will still be Black, and you still won't, I mean, they still won't value you the same in society. You could still, you know, maybe you can afford not to be caught up in certain situations. You can afford bail. You can afford expensive attorneys. You can afford all of these things. But if a white cop doesn't know you're Kanye, doesn't know how much money you're worth, like, you could end up in the same exact situation, because ultimately you are a Black man and you have dark skin, and they see that as threatening.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you there are people that, you know, that know that they're, you know, probably white folks that know that their kids listen to his music and all of that and are probably still not fans, regardless of how much money he makes, regardless of who he's married to, regardless of the fact that he is a Trump supporter.
Yeah.
Like, there are still people that do not care about that.
Yeah.
And that won't care. There's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
You can't buy it. You can't buy the access.